Stay warm and save every day. All in the Kroger app.
Get tender Heritage Farm boneless chicken breast for $2.49 a pound. Then find low prices on thousands of items like sparkling ice water, Kroger brand chips, and more, all with your card.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Myself. That's the problem. That's the whole problem with the whole thing. That word. Self. That's not the word. That's not right. That isn't. How did I forget that? When did I forget that? The body stops a cell at a time, but the brain keeps firing those neurons. Little lightning bolts like fireworks inside, and I thought I'd despair or feel afraid, but I don't feel any of that. None of it. Because I'm too busy. I'm too busy in this moment, remembering. I remember that every atom in my body was forged in a star. This matter, this body is mostly just empty space, after all, and solid matter? It's just energy vibrating very slowly, and there is no me. There never was. The electrons of my body mingle and dance with the electrons of the ground below me and the air. I'm no longer breathing. And I remember. There is no point where any of that ends, and I begin. I remember I am energy, not memory, not self. My name, my personality, my choices all came after me. I was before them, and I will be after, and everything else is pictures picked up along the way. Fleeting little dreamlets printed on the tissue of my dying brain. And I am the lightning that jumps between. I am the energy firing the neurons, and I'm returning. Just by remembering, I'm returning home. It's like a drop of water falling back into the ocean, of which it's always been a part. All things a part. All of us a part. You, me, and my little girl, and my mother, and my father. Everyone who's ever been. Every plant, every animal, every atom, every star, every galaxy, all of it. More galaxies in the universe than grains of sand on the beach, and that's what we're talking about when we say God. The One. The cosmos. And its infinite dreams. We are the cosmos dreaming of itself. It's simply a dream that I think is my life every time. But I'll forget this. I always do. I always forget my dreams. But now, in the split second, in the moment I remember, the instant I remember, I comprehend everything at once. There is no time. There is no death. Life is a dream. It's a wish. Made again and again and again and again and again and again and on into eternity. And I am all of it. I am everything. I am all. I am that I am.
Cheers and welcome to the Desert of the Real. Welcome to Aeon Byte. My name is Miguel Connor and I am your pompous of gnosis, that smell of colitas rising through the air of a world gone mad. Good to have everybody here on the live show. Of course, it's always replay on all podcast platforms and other video platforms, but good to see everybody here on this moon day. And today I am very excited to have someone who is long overdue, who has always helped me and whose book is truly amazing. And that is Jeff Kripal, to discuss his new book, How to Think Impossibly. The tagline is about souls, UFO, time, belief, and everything else. Although I think the tagline should be, it's just a ride. As that's somebody who Jeff quotes a lot in his book, and that's the mighty Bill Hicks. Jeff, thanks for coming back.
Thank you. Thank you, Miguel. Thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure and an honor. And with us, too, to always help us out with his own gnosis and to take care of the chat room is Graham Pong. Graham, how are you doing?
Oh, very good, Miguel. Looking forward to hearing the confluence of the infinite and the impossible.
There you go. There you go. And I'm glad you guys are here. Jeff survived the great snow in Houston. Graham has survived the great freeze in Florida. So I hope you guys have thawed out from your from the punishment of the Norse gods and are ready to chat. So awesome. As always, if you have any questions for Jeff, please super chat them so that Graham can get to them. Not much housekeeping. On Wednesday, we'll have Dr. Sid Robb. She will be discussing the tripart tractate from the Nag Hammadi Library, and we'll focus on Gnostic psychology and also preparation for death from the Gnostic viewpoint. But yes, it's still just a ride. So, well, Jeff, let's start. How did this book come about? It's based on what, inspired by your annual conference that you do?
Well, it came about, I mean, actually, there was a book before that called The Superhumanities. And I tried to lay out this case for why the humanities are already super and why they should be super in the future. And my editor there basically said, okay, Jeff, well, how do we do this? How do we make the humanities super? And I was like, wow, that's a good, I'm not very good with practical questions. So How to Think Impossibly is basically a kind of how-to manual on how to make the superhumanities stick, as it were. And so I basically took a bunch of talks that I had given over the last couple of years and I wove them together into this book, and there it is.
Yeah, I see your book. So full of great stories and characters from Kevin and so forth. Of course, you bring the usual suspects, Philip K. Dick and so forth. But I see it as sort of a call to, again, shift our perspective. I think you write, and I wrote down so many notes, you write, traditional religion or conventional science will never get us to the solution or resolution of impossible phenomena, not because we do not have enough data, but because these two knowledge systems are inadequate in principle. And then you mentioned a joke you give that nobody ever gets at conferences, that to understand UFOs, you must have radar and revelation. And I got it, but I'm like not surprised nobody, few people get it, right, Jeff?
Yeah, nobody laughs. I'm glad you, I mean, you can laugh because it's your show, but I mean, no, it's a joke that falls flat because the terms are not understood.
Yeah, it's kind of like, well, at least it's better than, you know, try the salmon, my arms are tired joke. So at least you're trying something new, huh?
Yeah. I you know, Miguel, it's a serious comment, but I like to joke because I think jokes encode a lot of serious thinking and people can hear jokes where they often can't hear serious thinking or it's too abstract or it's too thinking, like where a joke is like, oh, it's like this punch that like either get it or you don't, you know.
Well, that's what Oscar Wilde said: if you want to convince somebody, make them laugh or else they'll kill you.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's right. I also think, I mean, this is getting a little nerdy, but I think real humor or a certain kind of humor is transcendental in the sense that it kicks you out of your worldview and helps you to kind of reflect back on it. And that's really what I mean by impossible thinking. I mean, thinking, not thinking your thoughts, not believing your beliefs, but being able to look back on them and ask questions of them.
Exactly. Yeah, indeed. And yeah, like you said, the problem we have is that, for example, UFOs now are the big thing. I always think, you know, we started talking 15 years ago and we were the fringe, right? We were the kooks or whatever. Right. Now it's almost like it's flipped and we're telling the government, no, you're the kooks. You're believing stuff that's not real.
Right.
Do you feel a little irony in this, how things have shifted?
Yeah, I get asked that a lot. You know, I've been writing about UFOs for almost 20 years now, and the context really shifted in end of 2017. On the other hand, that shift implies some kind of what I call a fear narrative or a Cold War invasion narrative. It's still about they're here to conquer us or to invade our sacred airspace, which I don't think is true, of course. And so the attention, what I'm trying to say is the attention is good. It raises the topic and the public attention, but the way the narrative gets spun out and told, I think is quite bad. And it's hard for me to hear, to be quite honest.
Yeah, sometimes when I've watched the whatever Congress hearings, I'll picture like you, Jeff, just sitting there like on your TV, like, you know, sighing like heavily. And yeah, I mean, you do right. And I think that's a crux of the problem is that we have these lawyers and engineers taking this data and their thinking is completely wrong, as you write, for the UFO. And you're talking about in your section about the hearings. Seeing the hearings, we need much more philosophical nuances, historical awareness, scientific humility, comparative reach, and frankly, impossible paradox. So again, nothing's going to be solved until we learn to, you know, think impossibly, right? Change our perspective.
Yeah. And so one of the things I struggle with in the book is whether that's ever going to happen. I mean, impossible thinking is impossible for probably a good reason. I mean, people in general, and by people in general, I mean my own family. I mean people like us are not capable of this kind of reflexivity or thinking. On the other hand, and this is the argument of the book, embedded in the core of the humanities are these altered states, are these weird experiences that generated the ideas in the first place. And so we do have this literature and this means of awakening people to something else or something other, but it's coded, it's deeply camouflaged. And I wonder about that camouflage a lot. I wonder if it's necessary and to what extent what I'm saying, you know, can't be heard, essentially. I know you hear it, Miguel. I'm not questioning that, but
I got plenty of voices in my head, Jeff. Worry not, they're not going anywhere.
You're the last person I worry about. I mean, you're already way down the tunnel.
Yeah. I'm done. I'm cooked, as they say. And for the audience, I'm gonna say that Jeff, wrote a great testimonial, which is on my website, my new website for the book. He read the book and Jeff's research on how Captain Marvel was, you know, huge influence, obviously, on Elvis. And of course, there's a lot of high weirdness behind the whole story and mythos of Captain Marvel. And then I'm writing the David Bowie bio. It's a sequel, Elvis 2.0. And doing a lot of research found by Chris Knowles, I'm finding that Captain Marvel was also a huge influence on David Bowie. Yeah. So, and there's this weird nexus of Philip K. Dick, David Bowie, Ridley Scott, and Elvis. And again, I'm sure you find the same thing. You go down these rabbit holes and you're like, this is wonderful.
Well, you know, so I'm actually, I teach for a living. That's my day job. And this afternoon I teach this course called Mutants and Mystics. And
that's the book I reference. Yeah.
It's based on this book. And, you know, I'm not trying to sell a book, by the way. I'm just that's trying to talk book. About it. But what really that book is about is the paranormal experiences of artists and authors, and that encoded in these pieces of really adolescent fantasy. I mean, I was an adolescent. I know. I can tell you what reading comics was like in the 60s and 70s. It was oddly inappropriate, by the way. It was not quite right, but it was fantastic. It was great. But encoded in these stories are these altered states of these mostly men who wrote these stories and penned this artwork. And so I do think behind the comic book genre and behind the science fiction genre are actual paranormal capacities and powers. And I think what I admire, I know what I admire so much about the artists and authors is they don't try to prove them. They turn them into art. And I'm like, wow, that's a great response, you know? And they become wildly popular, you know, decades later now. They were not wildly popular, by the way, in the 60s and 70s. I mean, they sold comics, but they couldn't make the movies because they didn't have the CGI or the ability to do that. They do now.
Yeah, often banned as reading your book and others. It was fringe. It was very fringe.
It was very fringe. Comics were connected with juvenile delinquency, all kinds of things in the 1950s. Believe it or not, by a psychoanalyst of all people who should know better. But and so the comic book industry responded by trying to essentially clean up its act, you know, at least publicly. And so you get a lot of self-censorship in the late 50s and 60s that I think is really unfortunate.
Yeah, you teach this course, but what is interesting or the message in your book is that we can all think impossibly. And there are individuals who've reached out to you've gotten their stories and you have the arches. But as you say, I don't know if you do it before, but you told me last time you always let your students come and tell you the impossible things they experience, paranormal, UFO, all that. And always in your head is like, well, thanks for sharing, but I know it's far weirder than you're telling. You're holding back, even though you can trust me. You know, it's not going to leave the room. So everybody, I think, has some weirdness in their life.
Yeah, I mean, so that's how the book begins, actually. I curated this conference at Esalen. This was, I don't know, a decade ago or so. And I asked people to come with two things. One was the weirdest thing that ever happened to them. And the second was a theory of the imagination that would make that weird thing possible. And everybody came with a weird story. Nobody came with a theory of the imagination. Nobody. Nobody had one. And it made me realize that these things happen to human beings all the time, but at least in this particular culture, we actually don't have a way of theorizing them or making them sensible or meaningful. They just sit out there and the experiencers, as they're called now, suffer because of this, because they can't integrate their experience into the broader culture. And I think that's a problem. That's a real problem. And yeah. they're not just imaginary, you know. That's the only move we can make in our language. We just say, oh, the imagination is about schlock that the mind just makes up. It's about hallucination, you know, to use another loaded term. But it's not. It's really not doing that in at least some of these cases.
Yeah, exactly. One of the focuses of your book is Henry Corbin's idea of the imaginal and the imagination too. And that's and of course you can call it Jung's collective unconscious, the Pleroma, the Akashic records, something like that. But your book consists of your theory of the imagination. So perhaps one way to, you have a list at the end, one way to think impossibly is to understand that the imagination is the capacity of the brain that is a bridge, you might say, to the real world. Donald Hoffman, right? Time and space are not fundamental. You know, we're Bernardo Kastrup, you know, the primary directive of the mind is to lie so that we can eat, have sex, shelter, but we've occluded the real reality and it's there for us.
The book ends with this idea that, and by the imagination, I don't mean any at any time. I mean, obviously, we just imagine shit all the time. I'm not sacralizing or making special our fantasies, but sometimes the imagination acts as a kind of mediator or a translator. You know, something comes through it, and those are the moments that people do recognize as different than all the other moments. And this is where, you know, our ancestors talked about revelation. They this is what they were talking about, is this sort of passivity of the human knower to something greater that was coming in. And what I'm trying to say in the book is something is coming in, but maybe we can't trust it either. You know, I mean, what makes us think that's telling of the truth? I mean, come on. I mean, so it's this deep suspicion of things, but you can't be suspicious like this unless you think these things actually happen. That's really what I'm trying to say. You know, and so the example I give a lot, which I actually am deeply persuaded by, is precognition. Mm-hmm. I think people have precognitive states all the time, particularly in dreams. They know what's going to happen before it happens. So with a precognitive dream, we know it's a function of something we can call the imagination. We know that. And yet it pertains to something that's happening in the physical environment. We know that too. So it's mental, but it's also material. It's a correct cognition of something that hasn't yet happened yet, but will. And that's what I like about, those are the kinds of paradoxes I like to get into, because it just blows up this notion that the mind and the material world are somehow separate.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, you bring up I saw some syncs. I got some syncs from your book. For example, in one part, you talked about 144 cases that the military has seen, and they've only been able to, whatever, disprove one. But, and then in the other one, 144 people died in that mine. I think it was Wales, right?
Yeah, it was in Wales.
But again, that number, obviously, Revelations, God saves 144,000 people from the Antichrist. But anyway, that's what was coming in my reality tunnel. But at the same time, so precognition, you contend that you're fine with the block universe model, because obviously it had to happen for us to, as Philip K. Dick said, remember the future.
I mean, so I use the block universe a lot in the book. It's not that I know that that's what the cosmology is, Miguel. I don't know that. I just, my goal though is to keep things on the table, as I say. It's like, look, these things happen. Don't tell me they don't happen. That's just not true. That's a bunch of nonsense. So if they happened, what does the universe have to look like to allow those things to happen? And I think the block universe is actually a really good candidate, because it does explain why people have precognitive dreams and visions, because the future's already happened. Mm-hmm. And they're accessing some state, maybe through their physical brain, which is, you know, in Eric Wargo's sense, is like pulled out through this fourth or fifth dimension. And the brain is just precognizing itself. And then it's generating these dreams or these visions as a kind of translation or camouflage of what it's cognizing. Okay, I like that. I find that convincing, but I like it because it keeps precognition on the table. It struggles with it. It tries to make sense of it in terms of our science and our worldview. And that's really what I'm trying to do in the book, is just, let's keep all this on the table. Let's not say things don't happen when they clearly do. And what does the universe have to look like to make those things happen? But that's really it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like you said, embrace the paradox, embrace the ambiguity. And yes, I was going to bring up Eric Wargo because his book, of course, goes into so much detail. Like, again, the death at the mines, 144 people had precognitive dreams. And Eric's done so much research right before 9/11. And of course, the Mothman Bridge, all that. So we are always remembering the future.
I mean, the collapse of the mine and the death of all the children in Wales, you know, it resulted in a book a few years ago called The Premonition Bureau. Mm-hmm. A psychiatrist started an actual bureau at a newspaper, and it didn't work, by the way. But his goals were laudatory. He wanted to essentially turn into a technology or turn into a reliable technology, people's premonitions, so that when an event was about to happen like that, that action could be taken to avoid it. Now, there's all kinds of philosophical issues embedded in that. And there's all kinds of issues of free will and all kinds of things that are just, this is what it gets you into. You start go down into this rabbit hole and you find yourself in all these other rabbit holes. Rabbit holes within rabbit holes within rabbit holes.
Yeah, it's wonderful and it's terrifying. I think one of the central themes also too, although there are many, I don't even know why I say central theme, but is you talk about dual aspect monism.
Yeah.
Could you tell the audience why it's important or what it is?
Well, yeah. I mean, again, this is my own philosophical position. I think everybody has a philosophical position. And whether you can name it or not depends on how much philosophy you read. But dual aspect monism basically says that the world is one. There's something deep down here that is neither mental nor material. It's both at the same time. But that it splits into a kind of mental world and a material world through the human being, through the human knower. And I like that a lot because, again, it's a world that makes sense of the phenomena I'm studying. If you're going to ask the question, what does the world have to look like to make these things possible? Dual aspect monism actually works. And the reason I like it is because if something splits off from this deeper unus mundus or one world, then the material world and the mental world are going to correspond because they're the same thing. They've split off the same reality. And this, of course, is exactly what you see over and over and over again. And so to me, it just makes a tremendous amount of sense. It also explains to me why the science is never going to get us there, right. You know, because science presumes a splitting between the mental and the material. It presumes a kind of subject-object dualism, which is true on an epistemic or human level, but it's actually not true on a reality level. And so I like that too. I think that's makes a tremendous amount of sense. It helps me think about science. It helps me think about the ego. It helps me think about synchronicity. It helps me think about precognition. It just helps me think about all of these otherwise impossible things.
Maybe it helps you not being angry at the cashier who screws up your order. Huh?
Well, I'm not angry anyway. Yeah. That doesn't bother me. I'm like, yeah, whatever.
Okay. Whatever. It's just a ride.
Yeah.
Stay warm and save every day. All in the Kroger app. Get tender Heritage Farm boneless chicken breast for $2.49 a pound. Then find low prices on thousands of items like sparkling ice water, Kroger brand chips, and more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yes, I like your, you have your credo, you write, I believe the world is one, that the human is two, and that this one world often appears in the human as two through the symbols, myths, and dreams of the empowered imagination. So again, the imagination is how we get through or connect or dissipate.
Yeah, I think again the imagination here, the empowered imagination is Jess Hollenbeck's language, by the way, for these special moments when something is coming through. And I think what the imagination as a dimension or function of consciousness is translating that coming through. And it's translating it into a visionary display or an imaginal experience that is revealed to the person. And the person knows instantly, usually, that this is not an ordinary dream or an ordinary vision. There's something going on here. So that's, yeah. And by the humanist too, I'm not subscribing to dualism. It's not that I think there are two things in the world. It's just that I think the human being is what splits this non-dual reality into two.
Yeah. And I like also too, how you bring up Jung and Wolfgang Pauli and the idea of synchronicities. And I think it's astute how you propose, the idea of meaningful coincidences, but you say synchronicity, those two cats we're talking about again, when these worlds are communicating, synchronicities, from our mind, the symbols is going out into the world and suddenly we have a back and forth.
Right. Well, that's Harold Altmanschbacher has helped me think about synchronicity and Pauli and Jung.
Yeah, indeed. And you also write, your life work is teaching humans how to be humans and gods how to be gods. And you admit, some humans for the most part aren't good humans and gods aren't good gods.
Well, I think the language there is teaching humans how to be God and God how to be human. I mean,
yeah, that's it. Sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. And what I mean by that is we've dealt horribly with people's experience of deification or divinity in the past, or we've isolated it or excluded it in just a single person, which I think is just a horrible mistake. And I think, so that's teaching humans how to be God and teaching God how to be human. God is at least historically an extremely violent and moral monster. And that's no good either, So it's sitting in between, the human and the divine and sort of giving both a bad time, as it were. But for, I think, good reason. I'm trying to affirm and side with the human beings who experience divinity, but also divinity that experiences itself as a human.
Exactly. You also write in a very Gnostic way, we are God in plurality. And then the next sentence you go, or God's madness. The old idea that something broke in the pleroma, there was some glitch in the matrix, and oh my God, we're humans. We forgot we were God. We're worshiping the wrong God. We're insane. The old movie, The Gods Must Be Crazy, that few people know about.
Yeah. Yeah, they are crazy.
Yeah.
I think that's Nietzsche, though, by the way. I mean, that's Nietzsche, I think I'm quoting there. And, I'm quoting philosophers of mind about whether, this sort of cosmotheistic consciousness is mad in some sense, as we say, certainly not human.
Yeah. Well, it's all about the speculation. I mean, even Carl Jung once said, show me a sane man and I'll cure him. I mean, what is madness? Plato had no problem with divine madness.
I mean, again, the book, it's speculating, but it starts with the experience. It starts with the experiencer and then kind of works out from there. That's really the whole method I'm trying to articulate, is what does it look like when we start with human experience and work out? And we have to deal with some pretty absurd and crazy, but also some funny things and also some sad and tragic things. I mean, there's a lot to deal with there.
Yeah, the human experience in itself. Graham, how does the chat look like? And do you have a question for Jeff?
Oh, the chat looks like it's pretty well behaving. They seem to be pretty into it. my thoughts on that I've had for Jeff is this is the first I've really heard of dual action monism. The one that I had settled on, you know, philosophically was dialectical monism, where the monad can only express itself as a duality, and it forms an inherent, you know, dialectical hierarchy that way.
Yeah, I mean, this is just our language, right? I mean, we're looking back on people's experiences and we're creating philosophical categories. I mean, theism, pantheism, panentheism, idealism, dualism, all of these are modern philosophical terms to kind of look back on other people's experiences, but also on our own experiences and come up with them. I suspect dialectical, I don't know, I've never heard the phrase dialectical monism, but it sounds to me a lot like dual aspect monism.
Yeah, I agree. It sounds like, you know, different ways to skin the same onion. The other thought that I had is what I have found useful in those impossible thinking is via Alfred Jarre and pataphysics, where he's dealing with inherently things like antinomies, which is the merging of opposites, and things like Kleinemann and syzygies. And I found that kind of useful for modeling some of the impossible thought. Have you explored any of pataphysics or Jarre sort of stuff, Tag?
No, I haven't. I mean, certainly paradox is central to the history of religions, but I haven't looked into those particular figures or ideas.
Very cool. But isn't that also the issue? And we've discussed this. You've talked about it in your books, like Supernatural. Language is also the key. We need to always, invent a new language. That's what figures like Carl Jung or Lewis Carroll or Aleister Crowley or many of the philosophers were doing. Language can also open new vistas, at least according to like Owen Barfield and so forth.
I mean, this is why you get poets, you know, as well. And I mean, someone like Nietzsche, for example, he's clearly using language, but in a new way, as it were, you know, because of his own insight. I think language is a problem because its grammar implies a subject doing something to an object. I mean, it's dualistic to the core. But you can then turn around and use language in a non-dualistic or an ungrammatical way. And I think that's where it becomes powerful. And, you know, the other thing to say is, people who have these moments of insight or revelation, they often write a ton. they're you know, they just can't stop writing because there's something about the experience that wants to be communicated. And this, you know, I mean, one of the other things I say in the book, Graham and Miguel, is that, you know, in the religions themselves, particularly in their contemplative traditions, you get this idea that, oh, just ignore that, you know, move on. Don't think about the weird shit, you know, focus on liberation or enlightenment or salvation or whatever the goal is. And what I'm trying to say is, don't do that. The religions are wrong. Those phenomena are appearing for a reason. They're appearing to get our attention. We shouldn't believe them, but we should be paying attention. Mm-hmm. And I really do think that that's true. And when I listen to human beings, when I sit down with them and really listen to them, these are often the most important things that ever happened to them. This is not tangential. Mm-hmm. This is not something to ignore. This is something to pay very close attention to and maybe spend one's entire life on it. And that's really what I'm trying to articulate here is a way that we can maybe do that better. Because I think Western thought in particular, Western philosophy, certainly my own academy where I live and work every day, it exists because it's taken off the table all this stuff. And it's reduced everything to this this small table that it can explain everything on that table. But I'm like, well, yeah, you can explain everything because you just took everything off. You can't explain. I mean, it's a trick. It's a trick. Don't be tricked. And I also think, Miguel, I don't want to get into the politics of this, but this has profound political and moral consequences. I think people are sick and tired of intellectuals and scientists telling them that there is no such thing as a numinous or sacred experience. I think they know better. And I think it was a disaster that intellectuals and political thinkers distanced themselves from the religious or spiritual dimensions of human beings. I think that was an utter disaster. And the reason I think it's a disaster is not because, again, I think those experiences are true or literally true, but because human beings do have this spiritual or in your case, Gnostic dimension. And not to talk about it is to dismiss what's the most important thing in a lot of human lives. And so I do think it has moral and political consequences.
Oh, I would agree, but I think materialism is on its last legs. It's a turning point, whether it's going to work out or make things worse, but at least it's a turning point.
Well, the thing about materialism, or that this idea that there's only insentient matter and that consciousness is some kind of epiphenomenon or accidental expression of it. Well, it's not the my joke a lot is it's not the materialism is wrong, it's that it's not entirely right. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that inadequacy, that hole in the middle of science, is where we are.
Bermuda Triangle.
I mean, it's a pretty big hole. It's like a gaping, it's a black hole, basically, in the middle of things. And I think we need to deal with that. We need to, like, turn the lens around and look at the looker, as it were. And so again, it's not that materialism is wrong. It's that it's very pragmatic, and that it can do certain things, but it absolutely cannot do other things. And they can't do other things in principle. Not because there's not enough data, or there's not enough science, or not enough technology. That is not what I'm saying. You know, the joke, this is another joke.
Yeah.
About my childhood. I was born in 62, by the way. And so this was probably the late 60s, early 70s. It was a Mad magazine. And it was about this, remember Mad magazine?
Miguel? Oh, God, I used to read it religiously.
Yeah.
I think that helped me be a Gnostic more than anything.
Yeah. There was this cartoon in Mad magazine, and it was this botanist. It was this really careful botanist who was going to look at this flower that emerged from the desert once every 20 or 30 years or something.
Yeah.
And he gets down and he looks at this flower, which just happens to be emerging, and the sunlight goes through his magnifying glass and the flower. Okay, that's what I think is the problem, essentially, is that we're using methods that burn to smithereens what we're trying to understand. And so it's not something external or fixable. It's something that is the very method of knowledge itself that I think is the problem. And that's hard. That's a hard thing to say, as you know.
It is. Yeah. Because we're using the same models to explain it. You and I are talking in linear time, you know, logic.
I'll give you a really contemporary kind of potent example. People will say to me all the time, well, prove it.
Oh no.
And my response is always, wait a minute, you want me to use the methodology of science to prove the methodology of science? And they're usually referring to something like the UFO phenomenon or something. They want some kind of empirical proof. And like, but that all that does is return it, reduce it, explain it to a particular worldview, which happens to be yours, by the way. Mm-hmm. And so it's not that I'm against the science or that I'm against the empirical proof of some phenomena, but to use that as the measure of all truth is to me nutty. It's just nutty.
Yeah, I just hand him some books by Mitch Horowitz or Dean Radin and say, here, you want more data? I'll give you Colin Wilson, Gary Lachman, Eric Wargo.
Yeah, but so more data is not going to do it,
Miguel. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, they're not going to believe until you shift your consciousness. Like you said, it's people are definitely stuck. And the idea, there was a comment I hear from my friend Anon Omos. One can go mad continuously searching for explanations of experienced paranormal encounters. And I think that's kind of valid because, again, you talked about you have an experience, you write a lot about it. Philip K. Dick and his exegesis. Carl Jung and his red book. I think he wrote like 1,000 pages when he had his experience. But these individuals, the idea is it's a lifelong playing with, isn't it, Jeff? You're not going to solve the mystery. As Frank Herbert said, life is not a puzzle to be solved. It's a mystery to be experienced. I mean, the experience is the transformation. That's the end game, I think.
Well, again, I mean, the commentator's words, explanations, I mean, that's a scientific, term. Mm-hmm. This isn't about explaining or reducing something to a set of causes. That's explanation, by the way. Mm-hmm. This is about understanding the message. It's about shifting the way of looking at things from a scientific to a more humanist or hermeneutical lens. What does this mean? What is this saying to us? Not what is the physical cause of this? That's really not the question.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, it's a long process and we all have it. And as you say, we all can think impossibly.
We can't all think impossibly. I mean, that's been certainly my experience, but again, it's encoded in these humanist documents and texts and kind of classical canonical literature in the humanities.
And were you ever a David Lynch fan?
You know, I never was. Of course, I know who David Lynch was, and I watched some of the movies, but no, I was not.
But I think his movies and his idea of life being sort of a dreamscape, I think that really helped a lot of people in Western culture. His movies were very impactful, mm-hmm. and he brought a lot of, again, the topics that we talk about in the show, but he framed it always in this sort of dream time non-linear world. So I think his impact was good.
Yeah.
Any directors or artists you like?
Well, I mean I'm a big science fiction buff. I think science fiction is a lot like superhero comics. Sometimes it's about taking an experience or an altered state and turning it into a piece of literature, and I think that's really important. And you can communicate, you can tell stories that are still, it's still fictional, but it's not fictional. I mean, there's like this both and going on that I think is really powerful and helpful.
Yeah. Jeff, we also recently did a show on the Twilight Zone. That's another form of medium that really shifted the consciousness of man, just as more than the 60s drug culture or music. The Twilight Zone was the place for high weirdness, right?
Yeah, look at it. Look at how that did. Just even the language, the opening language in the opening sequence.
Yeah, it's pretty good. And I have this quote that I love from your book by William Blake. It was a letter to someone.
Oh yeah.
And I'm gonna make it a meme, as they say. But if you don't mind me quoting it, the guy was talking about his views on Christianity, like kind of asking, "Are you a heretic? Where are you going theological, Bill?" Bill Blake, not Bill Hicks. And I love William Blake's answer. We are all coexistent with God, members of the divine body. We are all partakers of the divine nature. He is the only God, but then so am I, and so are you. That was brilliant.
Yeah. William Blake was wonderful. Totally ignored, by the way, in his own life, too, for the most part.
Yeah, but then he became England's poet. So,
well, sort of. I mean, I have my own story. I wrote a book in 2002 called Roads of Excess, Palaces of Wisdom. It's very Blakean. The whole thing is structured around Blake. And the president of the Blake Society in London contacted me and asked me to come over there and give a talk. And so I did. And I gave this real nerdy talk on William Blake and the American counterculture. And like really when he came into his own was actually during the counterculture.
Yeah.
And nobody wanted to hear what I had to say. All they wanted to know was what would Will Blake do? You know, they'd give me one scenario. Well, what would William Blake do? It was just like you take Jesus and then you put William Blake in there and you've got the goods, as it were. And so it made me realize that William Blake was functioning as a kind of Jesus figure in British society in a way that I found really, really interesting, but also, you know, kind of troubling on a certain level.
Yeah, exactly. I always find it ironic, or maybe that's how the Gnostics and their smuggling ways is like England's poet is William Blake, whose cosmology is straight out of the Nag Hammadi library. Right. And then America's poet is Robert Frost. And you start reading, especially if you read Harold Bloom, you go, oh my God, Robert Frost was really influenced by Gnosticism. He was almost as Manichaean as it gets. And of course, you know, who are the two giants of American literature? Probably Herman Melville and Cormac McCarthy. Again, two individuals directly influenced by Gnosticism. So,
well, that's the superhumanities again, Miguel. That's what I'm arguing, is that there's this, we're certainly not all capable of impossible thinking, but it's embedded in our literature. It's embedded in our disciplines. And so people do, they read these individuals and they can kind of grok this sensibility that is always potential, as it were. It's always there.
Yeah, and maybe it's like your mentor, Jan Culiano, and of course, the Tree of Gnosis. I keep going back. It's like Heidegger. I read it and then I get it, but I don't get it. It's like a flash of lightning. So I have to go back to Heidegger and Culiano because, you know, they're writing at a level which is just amazing, right?
Well, I've said this in other interviews. One of my favorite stories, I don't even know if it's true, but it doesn't matter. It works. It involved William James and Hegel. And, you know, James's point was, I don't get Hegel. I read him and like nothing. But then he like sucked on some nitrous oxide or something. And then he read Hegel and suddenly, oh my God, I understand Hegel. Until of course the psychedelic wore off and then he didn't understand Hegel anymore. So that's what I'm talking about, is that even in someone like Hegel, there's probably some altered states embedded in the philosophy. And then people can pick those up without sucking on nitrous oxide by that. And the question is, why was William James sucking on nitrous oxide? Where did he get this nitrous oxide? I mean, how did that even work? I mean, I don't know how to get to nitrous oxide. I have no clue. But it does speak to this issue of impossible thinking being embedded in our canon, or in a canon, I should say.
For sure. Yeah. And like Culiano said, it's in the mind. The mind works with binaries, and there's always going to be a Gnostic idea, mystic idea that comes out. You know, historically, we can't trace when reincarnation, who was the first guy to said, hey, what about reincarnation? It's always going to be there, right, Jeff? So no matter what society, time, these ideas are forever.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I have here, as we get towards the end, I know you've got to go to your next appointment, but you talk about five ways to be ontologically shocked, which is from Johnny Mack. That's that, oh my God, red pill, if you would. And for the audience, please get the book so it expands because it's great. You say one, think impossibly. Two, get weird. Three, look up. Four, more real than real. And five, it's about time. So you do give advice on how to deal with these experiences?
I try to. I mean, that's my editor. He's like, come on, how do we do this? I'm just like, okay, well, I think this is actually how you do it. And the phrase ontological shock, by the way, is from the study of religion. John Mack got it from somebody named Paul Tillich, who was writing in the 50s about this ontological shock, this sort of sense that whatever is being experienced has it clearly shows that what we think is real is not.
Well, then there you go. Now you can deal with it. Well, as we get to the end, Graham, do you have a quick question or comment for Jeff?
I was just going to leave with the advice that my father gave me on the best way to do the impossible. That's to not know it's impossible before you do it.
Kids and artists do it all the time.
I mean, I have this funny poster in my study. It says something like, well, everything's impossible until somebody does it, you know, and then the person is shit Batman. That's who said that, apparently. And I'm like, well, that's not really what I mean by impossible thinking, by the way, but I get the sensibility.
Exactly. Awesome. Well, as always, it's been a great conversation. I have your book and your website on the show notes, but do you want to send people somewhere or announce anything that's going on, Jeff?
Well, so we are doing a big conference, April 1st to the 3rd, called The UFO and the Impossible. And people can either come and sign up in person, or they can sign up digitally for that. We don't have the registration up yet, but I hope we have it up this week, actually.
And this will be at Rice University.
Yeah, this is at Rice University, April 3rd to the 5th. And the website is impossiblearchives.org is the name of the website, impossiblearchives.org.
Wow. So that should be, yeah, especially.
It'll be awesome. And we're having some government people there, some scientists, but also some philosophers and historians of religions to kind of comment on it from their own. Everybody's perspective is going to be different.
Good. Yeah, that should be a great one. And are there replays for this afterward, or you just have to be there? Yeah, it has to be. It's a physical only conference.
No, it's not. There's a digital version of it. I mean, you can go online and you can register online. And we will likely post the videos on YouTube later, but you won't get the online kind of contemporary version of it unless you sign up for it.
No, makes sense. Well, check it out. Yeah, and check out Jeff's book, How to Think Impossibly. It's a great book. Yeah, definitely Mutants and Mystics. Again, great stuff for Elvis and David Bowie and others who thought impossibly and broke reality. Broke through the Black Iron Prison. But yeah, as always, first, Graham, thanks for keeping us company on this journey.
Thanks, guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Jeff and Graham. And for everybody else, we'll see you on Wednesday, and have a good rest of your Monday. And yes, think impossibly. It's right there. And okay, it's just arrived.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.